Welcome to Veterinary Ophthalmology, a podcast hosted by Dr. DJ Heusler, a board-certified veterinary ophthalmologist by the American College of Veterinary Ophthalmologists, and his co-host, John Lobby. Dr. Heusler owns and operates the Animal Eye Institute. Here, we talk about medical intervention, surgical correction, and current issues in veterinary ophthalmology. Our goal is to level you up in veterinary ophthalmology.
Welcome back, everybody. It is season two, first episode of season two of the Veterinary Ophthalmology Podcast. I am your co-host, John, here, of course, with the wonderful Dr. DJ Heusler. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you? It's Super Bowl Sunday.
I know.
We're recording a couple hours before the game.
I know. I'm very thankful that we could fit this in. We have a really special guest, though. I mean, I can't believe Taylor's on this. Oh, wait, no. Never mind. She's not on. We don't have Taylor Swift today.
We have somebody much better than Taylor Swift.
So we will jump right into it then. So DJ, why don't you introduce our Superwoman guest for today's podcast?
This is the Superwoman podcast, and I am incredibly honored that she will spend some time with us today, especially on Super Bowl Sunday. And so this is Dr. Ryan Angler. She is a doctor of veterinary medicine. She is a diplomate of the American Board of Veterinary Practitioners, both canine and feline practice. She's a graduate of Cornell University, where she received a bachelor's in animal science, as well as a graduate of Cornell College of Veterinary Medicine. Her CV is gigantic, and I'm happy to go through it. She has worked as a general practitioner right out of school, then went back to academia at Cornell, where she eventually became an instructor of community practice service, then moved to become an assistant professor of small animal primary care at the Midwestern University College of Veterinary Medicine, then became an assistant professor and clinical education coordinator as Kansas State University College of Veterinary Medicine, and now she is an associate professor and executive director of clinical and professional skills at the University of Arizona College of Vet Medicine.
You're right. That did take about the first half of the Super Bowl.
We're not even there. She has won the DVM 360 Veterinary Heroes General Practitioner of the Year in 2023. The Bayer Teaching Excellence Award for teaching second-year veterinary students in 2019. She was a nominee and finalist for the Zoetis Distinguished Veterinary Teaching Award in 2019. And she was the recipient of the Boehringer Ingelheim Teaching Excellence Award for outstanding instruction of first-year vet students. She has been committee chairs of multiple departmental committees, the sole author of 5 textbooks and co-author of 2 textbooks, written 20 chapters in textbooks, has 25 refereed journal articles, lectures within universities, designed multiple courses, lectured internationally, appeared on numerous podcasts, has been a commencement speaker at K-State College of Vet Medicine, has numerous research grants, and last but not least, she is an award-winning ballroom dancer with her instructor, Lowell Fox, at Arrowhead Staff in Peoria, Arizona, which seems to be a giant hobby and relief outside of veterinary medicine. So, all applause to Dr. Angler.
And no surprise, she's joining us on Super Bowl Sunday from her office.
Right.
Okay, with as much as you do.
Although we don't do video with a giant board behind her of likely goals, and I can't read it, but it's probably goals and directives of what she's going to be doing in the next 1 to 4 weeks of her life would be my guess. Just seeing that. So, Dr. Angler, welcome.
That's a good way. It's double excited. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Now you can fit 2 months worth of goals on it then. You just flip it around.
Yeah. So how are you, Dr. Angler?
I'm good. That was the best introduction I think I've ever had. Actually, I should have recorded that because I get imposter syndrome a lot. True story. So maybe if I listen to that back, I'd feel pretty good for those rough days.
Well, it is being recorded, obviously, for our podcast, so you can play it back anytime and realize that, you know, this is the Superwoman podcast, which is when I read your CV, but I've also known you for a few years now, and you've included me on some projects, which I'm eternally grateful for, of working with Lowell Ackerman and other projects where we've done some educational things, and really just very, very thankful for including me, because you are an educational superpower, and thank you for that. I greatly appreciate it. So I thought we would start off with, you are a person that, when I look at your path that you have gone from, it looks like on your CV, and is that you've gone from typical vet student wanting to go into private practice to then redirecting and going into academia. And that's not the easiest path, as you probably know, to revert. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a great story there. I think, yes, I was always kind of the typical vet student that saw myself going back home to practice in Maryland. I thought that I would end up at the same practice that I started at when I was 14, working in the kennel. And life has a funny way of working out. And that job didn't exactly turn out the way I thought it would right after I graduated. I ended up working at a different practice. That first job out was 16 months at that time. That was kind of the standard contract for a GP. And then I moved up to upstate New York. And when I worked full-time in upstate New York, I had a chance to go back to Cornell one day a week. And they had a practitioner in residence program. It was paying nothing. You basically got up at 4 a.m., drove all the way from Corning, New York to Ithaca, parked. They did pay for parking, which was a plus. And then you worked at the community practice service. And that's kind of like their primary care service. And that's the rotation that I absolutely loved in vet school. And the concept was you would be giving back to them and you would gain things, right? The opportunity to join some CE or other meetings. And usually there were older practitioners that chose this path. But for me, I thought, you know, let's give it a try. I didn't know then that I would love teaching. I just thought I could see myself being helpful to students in their clinical year. Cornell was honestly a really rough place to be a vet student in. I didn't have a lot of great vet school experiences. It was a lot of hazing by day and by night. There were few rotations I really loved. But the community practice service was one where you actually got to be the practitioner. You actually got to have your own patients, make investments and choices. So I thought, why not go? And maybe I can make things more humane, more kind, more warm, because that's just me. And I went and I fell in love with it. And I was there till, you know, I got there at the before dawn. I was there until 10, 11 at night, midnight. I had to stay till all the soap notes were done and proof read, and then drive back home. And I ended up staying there for 4 years for free, one day a week. And it was insanity, but I loved it. And that's what gave me the prompt to say, I will miss my clients in practice. I will miss my patients in practice. But maybe that's my calling, that if I can make a difference to 100 plus students a year, that they can then go out and do the best that they can be, then maybe that would be a better mission than me just doing it on my own in the clinic. And that started the beginning of what I'm currently at now. And yes, being steep mountain to climb, especially for generalists who aren't always welcome in the actual academic setting. So a lot of paths were kind of cut off for me. I had to do a lot of soul searching, getting more credentials, proving myself. And finally, I just achieved what everyone said that I had to get where I was. And now I still have new obstacles, but now I'm less afraid to try to push through them. I just say, all right, I'll just get better climbing shoes. And that's kind of the journey.
It's amazing because, you know, we haven't yet, we're working on trying to do video for YouTube and things for our podcast and whatever, mostly because John and I don't have a good background. We don't have a studio. No one wants to see us shoot it in some nasty garage or my dark basement. But if there was a video, you would see me smile this whole time, which was watching you right off the bat discuss hazing and uncomfortability in the university setting. And kudos to you for bringing that that out right off the get-go. Just like, you know, batter number one in Major League Baseball, you know, you're the leadoff hitter and you bring it right out. And that could open up a lot of discussion tonight for that. And so I thank you for that. That takes a lot, especially someone who works in a university to say that these are some things and some of those, and that actually I'm sitting here as we talk and on my computer, you know, I have a list of questions I can ask you, but that wasn't one that I was going to go into. But I do believe in organic conversation. And I think that, why don't we explore that? You know, what do you think about that hazing stuff? What do you think about that university sort of perspective? Like, talk about that if you're comfortable.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think it's something that, oddly enough, right, I experienced as a vet student in vet school. And at the time, I just thought this is normal, right? I graduated in 2008, so I started in 2004. And it was very much the attitude of, you're lucky to be here. Anyone else would have killed to be in your shoes. Look to your left, look to your right. Half of you aren't going to be here. And you all just secretly hoped you would still be the ones at the finish line, right? And at that time, you would have done anything and anything to get through. So you had 20-hour clinic days. You were on call at night. You never had weekends, right? And it was basically set me up for a life of vet medicine is your life, period. Mm-hmm. Right? And I don't necessarily know that's the healthiest way to go. And so it was very much a way I defined myself for years until 10 years ago when I found chance. That if someone were to have asked, who are you? I would have said, I'm Ryan Engler, the DVM. I would have been very proud of that, but I didn't have any other identities that I knew were me. Mm-hmm. I thought this is it because that's what I had been raised to do. And when I got into teaching and I tried to start, well, just being human, right? Asking students, well, what floated their boat? What made them want to go down this path? I found students that were so beaten up mentally that were like, I don't belong here. I don't think I deserve to be here. Everybody wants to see me fail. And it just broke my heart because I love this profession. If I had it to do over again, I still would choose this path. But what I found is that I often ran into faculty with the proverbial fork in the road. And it was almost this proverbial fork in the road. And you would talk about it in faculty meeting where people would say, I lived through that hell. Everyone should live through it. Mm-hmm. And you kind of make a choice as a teacher, right? You decide, do I do it the way that was done to me? Maybe not because that was right, but because everyone should experience it, or do I do it differently? And I told myself I would never go down the road of let's just make things hell for other people for the sake of that. And if I ever walk down that path, I better get out of teaching, right? So that was kind of a deal I made with myself along the way. And in the moments, I felt like I was by myself on this other fork, right? I went the fork of, why are we doing this? Let's think about what we're doing. And maybe we should give each other grace and regard and realize, you know, maybe somebody does need a break, right? When I went to vet school, you didn't get off for funerals. It didn't matter who died. Mm-hmm. It was, well, sorry, you're signed up to be here today. You didn't get off sick. There weren't sick days. It was show up with a bucket and vomit and take your exam. Mm-hmm. And if you get a zero, you get a zero. I developed a formaldehyde allergy in vet school that was life-threatening. And one of the then leading specialists said, first year, you either live or die. There's no disabilities, period. Right? There wasn't a student affairs office. And I just thought to myself, I'm lucky I lived through that. But why shouldn't someone get to go to a funeral? If someone's deathly ill, I'm sure they would want to take the test and not have the flu. Like, let's think about strategies. And so I think that's the way I've tried to live my life. It hasn't always been popular. And I think a lot of times that attitude paired with what I teach often kind of crafts me as, well, you're basic. You just teach the physical exam, or you just teach documentation and medical records, or you just are soft, right? But I think that's what sometimes this world needs, because in a way, the attitudes and the frustrations that sometimes I see percolating in our profession at our clients, I feel like it's a reflection of how we've been treated. And we get bristly when the clients get irritable. But maybe someone needed to show us regard so that we could show the client regard, right? Yeah. And it's this circuit, right? We got to break that cycle.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I mean, if you're definitely soft, you know, and if you're soft, I'm soft. You know, I agree with you.
I just can't believe that in 2004, you know, you said you were going into vet school, that it was still that, there was still that thing of look left, look right. I thought that stuff only happened on like Grey's Anatomy. That boggles my mind that is actually how people, now it's 20 years ago now, but still, I mean, I think I commend you for really standing against that sort of behavior, because I mean, hell, if we taught ourselves today the way we taught ourselves in 2004 on anything, I mean, it would just be ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and again, you know, we're about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes into this podcast, and no thought that this is the direction that this would go, but I'm happy to, because it's important, and I figured that, you know, this is kind of what would happen with some of these conversations is to, you know, important conversations as to what's important to other people. But, you know, I'm 2 years, you know, I think you said, Dr. Engor, that you graduated in 2008, I graduated in 2006. So I'm still in that same sort of, you know, area. And I went to undergraduate at Ohio State, and I was in a fraternity, and, you know, I would honestly say that I was one of the first people in the fraternity that was like, we do not need to be hitting other men on the rear end with a wooden paddle. This is ridiculous. You know, like, this is just, you know, and call me soft, call me whatever you want. I don't care. You know, I'm a guy that stands on 2 feet. So, you know, like, whatever, call me whatever you want, you know, but I didn't feel that was appropriate. And there's a lot of behaviors in vet medicine that are also not appropriate, you know, and I come from a family of where my father was a veterinarian, and I grew up in the practice, and, you know, this is how we've always done it, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when I did my internship, I also had one of the most badass internal medicine doctors I've ever worked with in my life, who is just one of the most badass people, let alone females, that told me, DJ, when you think that you're really important, when you think you're a really big deal in your life, however many degrees that you have accumulated, just remember that your patients take a shit outside. And I thought, that was awesome. That was humbling. Right? Like, that's humbling.
It took me a minute.
Right?
And like, I was like, what people are bringing their animals in that these people take a dump outside? Well,
like,
but then I realized
I love my patients, I love my clients, but I'm not working on the next potential congressman, president of the United States, any of that kind of stuff. So, you know, it was humbling to say, like, you need to realize what you're doing in life and do the best you can at it, but don't take yourself too seriously. So, and yeah, I've gone through obviously a lot of hazing and things, and honestly, to be frank, it still continues. You know, you go through committees, and here I'm a board certified ophthalmologist and have to deal with various committees and things, and yeah, you still get bullied. You know, had a couple instances these past couple weeks where you still get bullied, and you're like, wow, this is still happening, you know? So I thank you for bringing that up. That's important, and I appreciate you, because that's a sensitive subject that not a lot of people will, you know, will go after. So thank you for that.
Thanks for sharing your stories as well. It acknowledges and affirms we've still got a lot of work to do in our profession, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We have a lot of work to do. There's a lot of gray areas and skeletons in the closet and things that other people don't realize. So yeah, I thank you as well. So if we talk about teaching and what your forte is, so what do you consider, if you don't mind sharing, your the most critical skills for veterinary students to learn during their education?
Yeah, that's a good one, right? And I'm fortunate, I'll say that I have the advantage of the fact that I can meet students during orientation that first week of fall semester and continue with them for 2 full years, right? So I can kind of play around with that curriculum as we go and see where I'm meeting them at and what the needs are and kind of infuse that along the way, right? I don't get them for one semester and then pass them on to someone else. So that sets up a situation where I can really help infuse lifelong skills. And I'd say the big things that I really focus on in the professional skills curriculum is communication. Communication is one of those soft skills that still has that kind of mindset, but that reality of how do I connect to others? How do I communicate with others? Yes, the client for sure. Also the patient and also team dynamics, right? How do we actually navigate and agree to disagree in some cases, but also recognize that we can understand where someone else is coming from to the best of our ability and maybe still not see eye to eye, but we can appreciate what choices are made, right? So a big skill that myself and I partner with Teresa Graham Breath, she and I both lead that professional skills coursework, is focusing on understanding, recognizing, defining our own self-identities, professional, personal, and others, understanding ourselves better before we actually try to understand someone else, and then putting the pieces back together. So we have 30 communication simulations in our curriculum with actors in exam rooms that are videotaped. Students are not graded on the experience in the room, right? It doesn't matter to me if that student freezes in the room and doesn't know what to do, and we have to pause and reset. That's not a failure in my eyes. I think that's bold and courageous and mature and realizing we get stuck in real life. This is your safe, supportive space. It's about how you can reflect upon that experience. So I would say at the end of the day, it's reflection about anything you do that is the biggest too. Because I always share life stories with my own students. I talk about the hard things, the medical errors, the cases, the patients that I made the wrong choice with and they died, right? The things that most people don't want to talk about, because I say, I can't control everything. I can't control every outcome. I'm going to go in a room and say the wrong thing. I'm going to go in the wrong room and blank out. I'm going to forget something that I need to say or tell the wrong thing by accident. That happens because we're people. What's important is how do I then reflect upon that to make the next experience better and different? And if I can teach those skills, then we can get past the, oh my God, I sucked, I'm a failure, to I'm human. Life happens. So how do I make it up to that client? How do I have an honest conversation? How do I say, I don't know? And how do I partner then and get past the scary things we don't want to have to say to then have some of the best relationships that we can make and build?
Man, that's powerful. Yeah, really. I mean, to say that you're an educator and say, you know, these are things I messed up in my life. You know, and that's hard, you know, and I was once told a while ago that lecturing about veterinary ophthalmology is that if you get to the point where you can lecture of complications and show your own videos, you've achieved success, because then you're comfortable, you know, and I'm happy to say that, hey, I guess I'm there. You know, like I can show those and say, this is what I've, you know, done, not right. And here's how I can help other people. So I think from an educational standpoint, where you're at also is that that's a huge deal to say, these are things that I've messed up. And honestly, that's where the growth occurs, right? I mean, that's what they want to hear. They don't want to hear, you know, these are the best case scenarios. Here's how to do it. Textbook, whatever, you know, like here's how I messed up in my life. That's where the growth really occurs. So,
you know, I'm fascinated by the simulations and
in my professional life, I work for a health system, and there's a couple residency programs across the hospitals, and the simulation center is always my favorite to go visit, because I get to that whole dynamic around teaching how to be part of a team. And you know, when you watch the videos back, you see somebody who just ascends to like the leader role that, you know, sometimes you wouldn't normally see do that. But folks get to learn so much now from video of themselves that probably, you know, back when we were all in college, it wasn't maybe it was towards the beginning of when those things were kind of being used. But I say all that to ask, what continues to surprise you when you see those, when you're conducting those simulations? And I'm more curious around the simulations of the conversations. What continues to surprise you or stands out when you observe those communication simulations from your students?
I think what I would say is that those that commit and bring it and bring it fully are often surprised by the emotions or the reactions that they didn't anticipate, right? So, for example, tomorrow we have a euthanasia simulation. They're not actually injecting anything. It's an elderly cat case where the client has done everything and anything, and we're at end of life, and there's not an ethical reason why we can't euthanize. So it's their first opportunity to talk through, does the owner want to be present? What are the body aftercare options and things like that? So everyone thinks going in, that's going to be the most difficult, right? I would say a lot of people, I shouldn't generalize, but many worry about that one. But it's the moments in the other ones where maybe they're just delivering bad news. You know, it's a racehorse. The horse can't race for 8 to 12 weeks, right? And then it can go back to training. Or it's the puppy with the new heart murmur. That is probably physiologic, but the client is completely distraught. And now you have to talk them through that. And these moments where sometimes you least expect that you're going to feel something or connect. And then when the students will write their post-encounter reflections and reflect upon it, wow, I never thought that the client would say that to me, and I didn't know what to respond with. Or, oh, that reminded me of that time when I was 8 years old and that happened to me. And I didn't think about that for years. And in that moment, now I realize I understand that person. And I think that's the really beautiful part. It's the light bulb moment about what you would think are not light bulb things, but that if we can just connect in any fraction to someone else, it makes that conversation much easier, because now I'm not them. I don't know what it's like to be them, but if I can at least relate, and there's that humanity there of like, you know what? Okay, we're in this together, which is really what I see consultations, right? It's a partnership. And we've transitioned majorly from being that sage on the stage, right? When I was in vet school, you never questioned the authority, and right, you were supposed to go in and tell them everything, right?
Right.
And now we're the guide on the side, right? And that phraseology I borrowed from Jane Shaw. I don't know if she invented it or took it from somebody else, but I always remembered that moment in simulation where we are that guide. We're on that shared decision-making plan. And now suddenly we see that person not as a client, but as a human being. Mm-hmm. And now I think that's where we can affect the change and be more real. And those are the moments where I'm like, yes, that's it. That's what it is. Because the medicine is the easy part. We can memorize what to do in the textbook. It's how did you integrate? How do you work with someone? And how do you also work through conflict? Because you're not going to agree with everybody. Everyone's not going to like you. That's okay, right? Everyone doesn't have to be our best friend, but we still have to work with them. So what does that mean?
What percentage of your curriculum focuses on this, the interpersonal side?
That's a good question. I don't necessarily have a percentage, but our current curriculum is 3 years year round. So 2 years, 6 semesters are preclinical curriculum. And I teach professional skills in every single curriculum or every single semester. So it's a core course for 6 semesters. And then clinical skills, I teach with a core faculty and staff who are dynamos. They're amazing. We teach for 4 semesters and then hand the students over to sophomore surgery. So we build in kind of those day one ready skills. So I'd say it's a good percentage.
Yeah.
And we actually credit the credit hours that go to professional skills is 3 credits compared to 1 credit of clinical skills. So it actually is coding how much time they're spending in those dialogues.
You know, one thing that I always also talk to my residents and interns about is about, you know, interacting with the community where maybe they, you know, had an interaction with the business as to how they felt they were treated and how maybe a mistake was made or whatever, and how that business, you know, corrected on that, how they made you feel. And also, you know, as I've gotten older, to say, you know, look at that correction and say, was that, you know, it may have cost the business some money to help you, but like, how did that make you feel? And was that a good way to do it? Because I feel like in vet medicine, a lot of times we hold up this iron gate of, you know, like we're not going to do anything for them. You know, we're not going to, you know, we're just going to say they're crazy or they're, you know, they're abusive and we're going to fire them as clients. And, you know, darn well, if you go to a restaurant, a lot of times that, you know, if your meal isn't cooked correctly, they'll give you a discount on it. Or if you go to a bar and, you know, your drink, you know, you weren't happy with your drink, they'll give you a free one or whatever. And so, you know, a lot of times I'll say to my residents, like, we're going to fix this surgery, you know, because, and we're going to consider it that we're giving them a drink on the house, you know, and that's just the way it needs to be to maintain long-term relationships and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, I agree that some sort of feeling and empathy comes a long way to how to help the community and not being jerks, to be honest with you. Like just realize, I mean,
be humans having a human experience.
I mean, it occurs also. I mean, granted, there's people out there that treat us very poorly in veterinary medicine, and honestly, we need to get rid of those clients. We need to fire them for our own mental health and say, this isn't going to be tolerated, and you know, you can go find another veterinarian. But sometimes you have to say, hey, look, we're going to help you out. Like, you've been here with us for a while and we understand you're upset, and here's what we can do to help you. And so I think that there's an empathy level that needs to be taught also, rather than just being jerks as veterinarians. I mean, because we can be jerks, right? And just say, like, ah, we're not going to deal with them anymore. Screw them. They're out of here, you know? And it's like, that's not appropriate. That's not an appropriate way to handle people, you know? So,
yeah, absolutely. I hear you. I think there's a trend and tendency to fire everybody.
Yeah.
Right? The minute there's pushback, the minute there's a disagreement or dispute, we see it all the time on social media, you know, and let's just get rid of the problem. And I think, you know, kudos to your point. Let's invite the problem in. Let's talk about it. Mm. Let's talk to that. And in fact, some of my best client relationships over time were those where I could actually sit in the discomfort of the situation with them, hear that I had wronged them or they perceived that I had wronged them. And then how would I make that up, right? And how do I hear and affirm what their experience was and try to make that right somehow? Right, whether that's payment or any other way, right? I think that's important because we can solidify and learn things about ourselves, because I think it's very easy to go the route of they're crazy. They don't know what they're talking about. They're nuts. But what I always say is, let's think about what we can gain from them, right? One of my favorite conference talks I ever did was about, what do we do with Dr. Google, right? In the room, everyone in the room's cringing because they're like, oh, this is going to be about bashing everybody that brings up internet searches. And then most of the people in the room were kind of horrified because I went down a different path of like, I can work with a client that Googles things. You know why? Because they're invested. Mm-hmm. That tells me they want to know stuff about their pet. Now, it might be all wrong, but it's malleable, right? We're together and we're like, okay, I'm glad you spent 20 hours of your life looking at this disease. It tells me you're all in, right? That's not scary to me anymore. As a new grad, it was. Now I'm like, this person is invested. Great. I can work with that, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, on my end, when, you know, clients will bring up, hey, doc, I looked at this on Google and I know how you feel about this because of that attitude that we have. And my response is always, I don't care. Like, if you look that up, bring it to me because it's my job to know that information. Now, granted, I get it as a specialist. It is my job to know all that information and be able to handle it on the spot, in the room, whatever. But it's a better client. You know, like, and my response is always, well, if you have a problem with your pet, your car, your child, your personal health, what are you doing at night from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock? You're probably Googling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so I'm like, why are we jerks about Google when, like, that's what we're all doing at night? You know, so, like, just, I think a better response is, man, I really appreciate you looking this up and, like, give me your resources. And by the way, I'm going to go look that up tonight and I'm going to get involved with that. You know, so, like, I understand there's boundaries and, you know, how you handle your life and all that kind of stuff. But, like, you know, maybe spend a little bit of time in between cases instead of Facebooking or Instagramming or on Reddit or whatever and look up these things that are concerning rather than just being like, well, they're insulting because I have a DVM degree. That's just not appropriate. That's not, in my opinion, not.
Well, in life, so much of your success in life is the posture you respond from, right? Like, I remember, you know, being part of a very large organization with tens of thousands of employees. You have all these groups that you work with, and I remember that we were comparing one department to another, how they were easier to work with. And somebody said, it's just like they start from yes. And they go from there to say, sure, that probably could be done. Let's figure out how to do it. Whereas another department would just be, you know, a brick wall. That's not the way we do it, right? Mm-hmm. That's not our brand, or that's not our standard operation. You know, that's not how we do this, right? And so I think when you were talking about that, but the first thing that came to my mind was that has to be pretty annoying if clients come to you and say, hey, I looked this up and this website doesn't agree with what you said, right? If I were a practitioner and I'm on my, I don't know how many cases you see a day. I'm like on my 15th case and I've had bad experiences and this, that, and the other. I think it somewhat is human nature to get kind of ticked at that, you know? So how do you, I'm sure it's a very complex thing to do, but when you see that happening with your students in simulations, how do you pull them back from that? And how do you recenter them in the way that you were talking about seeing that as just, you know, this person's very, which really I believe to be true, is this person's very invested.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what we do with that in the moment in the simulation, and different programs run it differently, we don't interrupt in the moment. We often then get the student afterward working with us and we talk them through the process. But in class, we very often, we've built it in since the first semester of year one. And we continue to bring it back, which is, what is your reaction? And moving, how do we move from reaction to response, right? And so we do acknowledge, we normalize, we validate. Yeah, name what that emotion you're feeling is now, right? And we do little vignettes in class. I say little meaning small bite-sized pieces, right? That we can address in small group discussion and large, but it's okay to name that. Yeah, so there are times when, and I'm a really chill person, I don't tend to get bristly and aggravated, but I'll get defensive too, right? It's human, like you said. So let's name what we're feeling, right? We have little pauses. Okay, you've seen this part of the interaction. What are you feeling? Why? What does it trigger inside of you, right? And then we start talking about it, right? And we'll talk in our small groups about, oh, that reminds me when, you know, I was at the store yesterday and this happened or that. And then we talk about it and we're like, okay, why did the person do what they did? Let's think about now the shoe on the other foot. What is their intent? What's the impact, right? The intent with this person is they want the best for their dog. They want no stone left unturned. What's the impact? There is impact on you. You're defensive. You're frustrated. Okay. How do we bridge that gap, right? Let's address it. And so how do we move from that reactivity moment to response, right? The response is I'm going to table that defensiveness and I'm going to partner with them on our common ground, which is the dog's health. Now, afterwards, I still got to address the defensiveness. I got to do something. So we talk a lot about what do you do to get through those hard moments, right? What do you do outside of the room? Maybe you need to vent the staff. Maybe you need to go for a walk. Maybe you go in the bathroom because it's the only quiet place. Right? A one stall and you lock the door in and you don't have to go to the bathroom. You just are there for a minute, right? Yeah. Maybe we reset ourselves before we then carry it into the next exam room. So a lot of that stuff, which I think is a good life skill, right? Oh, we're driving on the road and something happens. Same thing.
Well, and it's just so important to break that down into understandable pieces like you just did, especially when you're preparing somebody for a career in this profession. But I'll tell you, when I was in a different management position, we had a whole morning long, you know, 3-hour portion of a leadership retreat talking about that very same thing, right? When you get into conflict or there is that difficult situation, how do you process it? And it is something that you have to learn once, but then you have to practice. You know, if you're going to be that, in this case, that clinician who everybody raves about, like, you know, you move to a new town and you need a new veterinarian, who are you going to call? You ask all your neighborhood friends, right? And or the school friends, and they say, go to Dr. Engler, right? Because she's kind, compassionate, and intelligent. And you get to that point, I would imagine, by being able to manage that emotion in that time. And it's something that will become, you look generationally, you know, people talk about their brand, right? That I would imagine this type of breakdown and getting good at that, like decompressing and breaking down how to respond to people. That's what's going to get people to want to come and be a patient at your practice.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about that stuff, but one of the things that I was interested in learning about, I think DJ has on here, is a little bit about your lecturing, because we talk about lecturing a lot on here. Do you want to jump into some of those?
Yeah. So, okay, we'll start with real simple stuff. So what is your favorite place that you've been to lecture?
That's a great question. I would say it's my international talks.
Yeah.
So it's a hard tie. Florence, Prague, and China. I'm going back to China pretty soon.
DJ's going to China.
That's exciting. Where at?
Shanghai. Just got the call last week. So where did you go in China?
Congrats. In June 2020, I went to Beijing and Wuhan right before the pandemic.
Whoa.
Now I'm going to Chengdu first week of April.
So it was you.
Yeah.
Probably. But I did a lot of good. So there we go.
Okay.
That's all amazing. Right. Yeah, I actually was asked to go to China in 2019, and who was coordinating? It wasn't so smooth. And so I pulled out, and it happened to be right before the pandemic, but it had nothing to do with the pandemic. It had everything to do with, you know, just the organization. And fortunately it was like, wow, that was a, That was a good decision to not.
Yeah, you're right. Mine was 2019, I should say. Mine was the summer right before.
I might have gotten stranded over there. You
could have gotten stranded. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that would be terrible.
But I'm super happy to go back, and I'm doing a cataract course with Dr. Jack in Shanghai. So I'm super, super stoked about that.
Have you been to Brazil? Fantastic.
Me, no. I was supposed to go to Peru, but then the World Cup happened, so the whole country shut down. I missed out. But I want to go a lot of places. What I really liked, and I think, I talked in the universities at China, but in Prague and Florence, they were conferences like we would have here. But I think why I really appreciate those is there's a different feeling that I can't really replicate here in the US. And what it feels to me like is when you go to those conferences, or I've had the fortune of going to two recently, everyone's there in it like cheerleaders for each other. And so what's really inspiring is when you're talking around dinner or, you know, wherever in breaks between lectures, never feels like someone's trying to one up each other. Right. There's this refreshing feel of like, oh my God, we're all happy for each other, right?
Yep.
And here, I cringe sometimes because I'll go and it becomes, who do you know? Who do you know? Do you know this person? Because we all have to prove ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't like feeling like I'm in the rat race because I've done it enough. I don't like to name drop and I just want to be me. But it feels like everyone wants to prove desperately who they are. Whereas overseas, it's, let's talk about all the cool things and partner together.
Well, you should just walk around. If there's a way that we can coordinate going to Brazil, let's do it, because that's one of my favorite places. But I 1,000,000% agree with you that when you go overseas, it's more of a collaborative approach than here. It's more of a, you know, who do you want to talk shit about it at dinner time? And it's like, come on, man. Like, that's not productive. You know,
you should just walk around with your CV in the States and just hand it out to people.
It's not
when you're walking by, be like, listen, I don't need to partake in this. You can read my CV.
It's just not appropriate. it's not the way to do things. You know, it's just, come on, you know?
Yeah.
I'll go to Brazil with you. Yes.
I'll go to Brazil with you. That's fine. Well, let's go. We'll figure it out.
Well, aren't you going? And when are you going next?
April. I'm going in April.
Yeah.
He's a lot more important than me.
No. Your CV blows mine out of the water. Your CVA is... No, not at all.
Yeah, interestingly, because of DJ's lecturing that he's done over there, we've had quite a few Brazilians join us on the podcast and in person. I mean, there were three of them that came over last summer for an externship. And what you said does not surprise me, because they're just each other's biggest fan, you know, and they're always learning from each other. And that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed about being a part of this podcast over the last year, is just getting to see that collegiality that happens inside of your professions. So I think there's probably a lot more of it than we're probably focusing on the bad, you know, the bad few experiences.
Well,
it seems like it's a pretty good group.
I think that there's, you know, internationally, they just like Brian said, is that they support each other, whereas here we do a lot of tearing each other down, and that's just not appropriate, you know. So I think we can learn something from the international community. So
yes, here is a lot of, well, you have to publish to be successful. So then somebody says to you, oh, I got published in this. Over there, people are like, that's wonderful. Let's talk about it. I want to hear about it. Like, tell me the conclusions. And here it's, well, what journal, right? There's this hierarchy.
Was it in the good
journal, right? And then you finally publish in the good journal, but well, what was it about? Was it about communication? Because that's really just not, right? It wasn't a real topic.
Yeah.
Right?
That's not real clinical. Journal,
real topic.
Yeah. That's not real. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
Well, one other thing that I wanted to kind of talk about, since we've been evaluating interns and residents for our program and things, is that class rank and pass fail And so different universities that have been transitioning away from either GPAs, class rank, that sort of thing. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. I would say our university is pass fail. It was determined before I came here. And we're just now doing away with class rank. Before, there was a time where students could still put in a request and get it from someone based on percentages. I think there's pros and cons. I think what we had hoped it would achieve is less freaking out over point to point, right? Like, okay, great. You passed the class. You needed a 70. You got an 88. Learn the material. Don't reach out and say, well, I got an 89.9. And you round that up to A minus, right? There was a lot of that when I worked at schools that were just grade attached, right? Which is funny to me because I came into vet school with a 4.0 and within one semester at Cornell got the first C minus of my life, right? So like I learned in vet school, holy crap, I'm not where I thought I would be. But I think the hope was it would make life easier in a way that could reward learning and not focus on the, oh my goodness, I didn't do as well as I wanted. You're still passable, right? And I think there's some good to that. I think what I've noticed is it really doesn't take away the point focus. I would say probably 7 emails, 10 emails every day. There's still a, well, I didn't do this assignment or I missed swiping in for attendance. And really, if I look at it, it's a 0.4%, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, that's negligible. Doesn't matter, but there's still this immense focus. I think it's carried over from undergrad when we were focused on every point matter. And that's not true of everyone's experience, but I worry we didn't achieve what we thought we were. We thought, okay, if we make it pass fail, it'll be easy. People won't care about every little individual thing. I think still it's about changing mindset. And we're not necessarily achieving that, right? The mindset of what does it mean to learn to learn? What's it mean to be a lifelong learner? Because at the end of the day, once you pass NAVLE, yeah, you may not have many big tests left unless you're going to be board certified. But life is still learning, right? You're still learning every day that you're in practice. So I think we got to do better. And I also do worry in the setup we have now, are we hindering those who do need to go on, who are trying to apply somewhere where they needed a GPA? I don't have the answer for that. I don't want to hurt people, right? By taking away something they need. I don't have an answer, but I think for me, I wish we could get beyond and just points and grades and just, what is your takeaway? Like, let's focus on that.
So my if I'm going to put the screws to you, On this interview, as a person that has to evaluate specialty interns and residents, how do I look at, because I also don't think that GPA and class rank are the be all and end all. You know, I think that I can train somebody way on down the scale that a university, and granted, I know maybe somebody will throw some comments at me about, you know, some hate on this, and that's cool. I can take it. I'm a big boy. But like, you know, I can train, in my opinion, a person way on down the scale of a GPA or a class rank and still get them board certified. I know that I can do that. Whatever. But if I'm looking at an application and if I'm looking at other diplomates of whatever, critical care, ophthalmology, DA, BVP, whatever the case may be, where they're just writing generic letters like, oh, they show up for work on time. They're happy. They're cordial, you know, like just nonsensical letters, which I receive every single year. And honestly, that's a different topic all in of itself, is not writing a good letter. But if we're not discussing GPA and class rank as to something that is objective, how do we start to look at these candidates?
That's a really hard question. I hear what you're saying. I think for me, and it might not be equivalent, right, to think about GP versus specialist. You'd have to tell me, you know, because we're in different walks of life. I think, what are we trying to get? What skills, what capacity in the students? What are the attributes that we need? And I guess I'm thinking about vet school applicants too, right?
Right,
not
sure.
Just past, but kind of similar, right? Because sometimes we'll look at GRE in some schools and sometimes not. I think the challenge there is, what do I really need to know from that student? When I'm thinking about students that get into vet school, I'm thinking all the outside of the box stuff that has nothing to do with the GPA. I'm thinking, tell me a time, like I wish I could come up with the interview questions, right? Mm-hmm. Tell me a time when you failed. And what did you do about it? Tell me a time when you were in conflict with someone and it didn't work out. And what were the ramifications and why, right? So I guess in vet school, if I was thinking about going on from vet school to internship or residency, tell me about a patient outcome that should have been successful, that wasn't, that you or your team played a role in, and take us through every step of that process from beginning to end, including what you said to the client, what you didn't. Now, I don't know if those would be personal essays, personal statements. That's a lot more work for you all to read.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's us directing the letter writers to say that. I don't know. There's not an exam for resiliency, right, that I can come up with or no. But I think that's what I want to know, because you're right. I can train people who don't have the numbers to be successful. So what are we finding in those individuals that didn't show up anywhere else?
Or for me, what are we picking? You know?
What are we picking?
Who knows? You know?
I don't know. I do know, like, you know, for clinical skills, for example, here, it's not really an answer to your question, but for us, right, when I worked at K-State, really all we were limited to how we could test the students. So they had a multiple choice for clinical skills. And it was like, that doesn't really help me to know who did it versus not. Here, it's not perfect, but we do OSCEs. So I know it doesn't translate ultimately to a score that you as a higher up person could get. But to me, having them do an objective structured clinical exam task, mm-hmm. that would be helpful, I think, for you all to know. We don't convey that. But to be like, this student went through 38 OSCEs over this period of time. This is what the subjects were in, right? Mm. History taking, greeting the client, delivering bad news, performing a spay neuter, developing an anesthetic protocol, like doing whatever specific tasks would help you.
Yeah.
Right? Working through a clinical opto case vignette. And we have all kinds of models that do fake tonometry and all kinds of stuff. Mm. And then making determinations.
What? Fake tonometry?
What? Yeah, where we have, well, we do tonometry, but not with real live animals.
What?
So in clinical skills, before they get to their clinical rotation, I have tennis ball eyes. I have...
What? How'd that come to be? Tennis ball eyes. How did that come to be?
Well... You helped a lot with my retinal exam ones, where you gave me great pictures for the back of the eyes, the back is ophthalmoscopy. But at one point, I was like, students need to learn how to do tonometry. And I don't have a patient set that I can just have them practice on. So I cut out, it sounds really hard, but I took stuffed toys and chopped them up and took out the eyes and got 3D printed eyes and put them in. And then had different materials for the surface of the cornea, right? For the tone of pen. And then you could have ones that did indent versus those that didn't. And then...
It sounds terrible, but it's also amazing.
It was really cool.
It's amazing.
And then you could have instant glaucoma. Like, oh my God, Fluffy has a problem.
Right. Poor old Fluffy, the dead tennis ball, has a problem.
Why is it always Fluffy?
It's always Fluffy or JoJo.
Lucky, bro.
Lucky. Lucky always has a disease. You know?
Yeah. Poor Lucky.
So I make all kinds of fake stuff. I'm working on fake, trying to create... I actually got a patent now on simulated urine crystals, so I can actually create microscopic prints. So now we can replicate any crystal we need on slide.
That's
to teach.
Unreal.
That's crazy.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're at the 1 hour mark. I would really love to do a second segment with you.
Sure.
I honestly, you just hit a lot of things that I really want to talk about. And you and I could probably talk for 3 hours. And so I don't want to keep your time on Super Bowl Sunday, but I would truly, truly love to pick your brain if you're able to, just because I love your outlooks on things. So if that's all right with you, what I'd like to do is turn it over to John for his Fast Five, where he'll hit you with some entertaining questions. But
who knows how entertaining they are.
But I'd love if we could do this again, if you're okay with it.
Absolutely. I will talk however long. So yes. Just reach out and we'll sign up.
I'm very honored. I love your brain. I love you as a person. You're an incredible dancer. So I love following you and Lowell on social media. And I encourage anybody listening to like go check out your stuff with you and Lowell Fox. And you guys are awesome. So
Where I was yesterday.
I know. I know. I
at
saw
6
it. I saw it. It's amazing. So I'll turn it over to John for some Fast Five and then we'll call it a day. And thank you again for your time.
I have a nephew who's a senior in high school this year. And I texted my brother and said, you got to get him to listen to this podcast because it's just, you've been so refreshing about, you know, what people can expect in an educator when looking at vet schools. So this has been great for me to be a part of as well. But these Fast Five are meant to be just quick hits where you can answer and maybe elaborate a little bit. Maybe we might jump into them, but meant to just be a little more fun to let people know a little bit more about you, the person, not the executive director of clinical and professional skills. So what is your favorite movie?
Oh man, that's hard. These are tough. I would say I'll probably get hate mail for this because there's dividedness in the movie fan club, but I'd say Pride and Prejudice, but the Keira Knightley version.
First one to go on
either
there.
People either like the original or the new one.
First one. Okay.
Or the new one. So you said you were dancing all day yesterday. Well, or at least you were there at 6 a.m. What is your favorite dance?
It depends on the week, but most weeks I would say is Paso Doble because I do 19 actual dances I compete in. But Paso Doble.
19? What? More than me.
See, that's one of the, I used to watch Dancing with the Stars a lot and I love that guy who is like, now dancing the Paso Doble.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I danced with Derek Huff on stage.
Yeah, Derek Huff. I got a picture on Facebook with Derek Huff.
What?
Yeah, seriously.
How did that happen?
And I was wearing flip-flops, which my teacher Lowell will never let me forget.
Well, yeah, hey, if you get a chance to dance with Derek Huff, you wear whatever damn shoes you're wearing.
Yeah, right.
There you go. But yeah, Paso Doble, I'll just add why, right? So a lot of people will be shocked or say, oh my God, that's the bullfight. How can a veterinarian dance the bullfight dance? I love it. But it's all an allegory. So whether it's good and bad, you know, life versus death. You can make it whatever you want, but I like the power that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And both sides, lead and follow, can bring it. And I think that's what I like. I don't really fit the really meek, oh, let me do the romance dances. That's a little weird for me. I can't tap into the act. I'm not that good of an actress, but I can be powerful and be like, boom. It makes you feel like you're alive at the end.
Oh, that's awesome.
I just have to always win at the end. Now, always dies if it's a fight to the death. He sacrifices himself for me.
So what, two questions that are not Fast Five related, but now I'm just fascinated. How did you end up dancing on stage with Derek Huff and what dance did you do?
That's a great question. The short of it is that I saved up a lot of my conference money because I couldn't find that would be reasonable for me to spend VIP ticket access to. So I paid for VIP behind the scenes to dance with him. That was 2 years ago-ish, July 2022, before my knee fell apart. He had nothing to do with that. Then a month later, I happened to have massive surgery unrelated to him, but I got to dance behind the stage with him. And I've been to his other tours and he doesn't have people come up on stage to dance with him. So I was actually there because the next day, Lowell was flying in for a major dance competition. So I wore my good shoes to dance with him behind the scenes. And then we had three other ladies, one guy who was going to dance with them. And one of the women said, oh, are you going to have us dance on your stage tonight? And he was really nice. No, I don't really do that. And so he's like, he looked at me. He's like, yeah, you rest your feet because you got your competition tomorrow. But I had talked to him for like a half hour about being scared of performing in front of people. And it was a big change in what I was going to compete in. So those are my questions to him. And I don't know, I have a feeling he wanted me to work through my stage fright because he told me to wear whatever I wanted. And then, surprise, he made me dance on the stage with him in front of like 500 people.
Oh my gosh.
And then the next day at the competition, I'm like, oh, it's no big deal because that's cool. So it got rid of all my fears, but we danced samba behind the scenes. We danced cha-cha and samba immediately. So that was super
cool. That is too cool. That is too cool. It's always nice when the celebrities are good people.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So what is a goal that you have yet to achieve?
27 more textbooks.
Yeah. Let's go up with 82. I have so much. Well, I would say my biggest thing that I'm still working on, I'm halfway there, but I want to be the first ever to create the first olfactory-based clinical skills lab. So right now, all of the education focuses on vision, what we see and observe, and tactile, right? What we feel. But we are diagnosticians that take into account multiple sense. So it took me 3 years, but I finally partnered with a mass spectrometrist, and we actually got the olfactory blueprint for canine parvovirus. So now I just have to partner with a perfumist, if we want to call it that, somebody that we can actually work on. And then we would have synthetic parvo, which sounds really crazy. Why would we want to smell that? That might be your next five question. But
that's awesome.
I think thinking about spectrum of care, right? And access issues, if I could somehow make a scratch and sniff of parvo and it's, you know, you give it to your clients and it's Sunday night and it's a puppy, deeper unvaccinated, get diarrhea, and you have this at home, and you're like, do I need to go to the ER now? Yes or no? And you have this, that could help them make a choice, right? About what funds do I need to save? So that might be patent number two. We're working on it. We're almost there, but hasn't happened yet. And everyone told me I couldn't do it. So I'm going to make it happen.
So what is a location in the world you have not been that you want to go to?
Oh, it would be a dream to be invited to go to New Zealand and Australia, but nobody wants to reach out. So if anyone in the audience wants me to go. Yeah,
come on, Kiwis.
It's going to take 2 years or less, and then someone will ask you to lecture.
Well, it's going to take 2 years to get there. I hear that's a huge long flight.
It takes one day.
Long flight.
Yeah, one
China's flight. A long flight. If I can do China.
Yeah, China's 27 hours is where I'm headed. In June, 27-hour flight time.
Wow. That's...
I can't wait. It's going to be worth every second.
Yeah. So last year on the Fast Five, we put a really polarizing question out there. You know, nothing real political, just polarizing. And we came to the conclusion that...
Nothing political. Don't throw anything out there political.
Yeah.
We're not trying to get canceled.
We came to the conclusion... Now, it wasn't a scientific experiment, but it was pretty scientific. For me, that a hot dog is not a sandwich. Now, you know, it's meat between two pieces of bread, but it is not a sandwich. So this year, I have strong feelings about this, but I want your opinion because obviously we've come to know your high level of intellect, and I'm just a doofus.
That's true.
Is pineapple a pizza
ingredient? Should
it be on pizza? Yeah. Oh, okay. Is it a pizza ingredient?
Oh, the good
Should
question.
It be on pizza? Yes.
Question.
Should it be on pizza? I have my opinion. I know what BuzzFeed tells me.
But
I don't want to sway you at all. I want your real opinion here.
This from a person that ate an entire pineapple in 2 days last week.
Oh, I love
I think pineapple should be on it.
Yeah, I'm with you. Pineapple needs to be on the pizza.
I love pineapple. Love it. Absolutely love it.
Don't tell me it shouldn't be on pizza. Don't do it.
There is absolutely no godforsaken reason it should be on a pizza.
Gosh darn it, you're the worst. Pineapple, no. Pineapple belongs on pizza. You're the worst person. You're getting banned.
It is. No, it doesn't belong.
You're the worst.
Doesn't belong. Yep.
The question is, have you actually tried it? Because you can't really say it doesn't belong if you haven't actually tried it.
Well, we have come to the end of our podcast.
No, well, guess what? You're getting booted.
No, we're not. Ryan's
now my co-host because you're out of here. Because she agrees with me. And
hey,
this will be a better podcast without you on.
Exactly.
It.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You're the worst.
You know what? Not everybody can be right all the time. I've learned that.
Yeah, and you're wrong all the time.
But Dr. Engler, we really appreciate you being a part of this conversation. We can't wait to have you back. We'll, you know, get you in like the five timers club with the like on Saturday Live. We'll have you on anytime to talk about all these great topics around education and the changes in the veterinary profession. But in the meantime, everybody, make sure that you follow at VetOptoPod on Instagram. At Animal Eye Institute is where you can find all the great stuff that DJ puts out. And we will talk to you next time, everybody.
Yeah, greatly appreciate your time. Thank you, especially on Super Bowl Sunday. Everyone, please follow Dr. Engler and all of her accolades and everything that she does because it's amazing. So thank you. And I would love, love, love to have you back in a few weeks. So thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast with Dr. DJ Hoistler and John Lobby. Tune in next time for more educational content and current events in veterinary ophthalmology.